The title of the talk today is Open Window. And the name partly comes from some paintings by one of my spiritual uncles, Henri Matisse. And in case you haven't come across him, this is how he drew himself. I don't know if you can see. Four different self-portraits of himself. Can you see? Just for fun. There's not a good picture of an open window painting in here. But these drawings went with an essay called Exactitude is Not Truth, where he's trying to talk about the importance of acknowledging that our experience is subjective and still can have a truth to it. And we could even kind of claim that subjectivity and allow our vision to go straight into the truth in what we're seeing and then draw that out. So he would draw that out in his paintings. And he encouraged, and in his drawings, he encouraged people not to just copy, but to really identify with what they were looking at. And then he said, it's always okay to exaggerate in the direction of truth. So we usually think of truth as objective. And he was saying, if we really go deeply into our subjective, truthful experience of life, even in something specific like a tree or his head in the mirror, we can bring out something that's more true than what we thought was the objective truth. So, that's Matisse. And he talks about his open window paintings. And in an interview, I think it was on the radio, a radio interview, he was asked, what is it that's so charming about your open window paintings? Because by this time he was famous enough to be on the radio and people knew about his open window paintings. And he said that, maybe I wrote it down. He said that there's a unity of space in what is outside the window and what is inside the window, that the wall that's dividing the outside and the inside doesn't divide, doesn't separate them. Let me just see if I find it. I don't think it's with the heads. I'll look for it and maybe post it instead of spending time looking for it now. But it's beautiful to hear the voice of someone who's simply talking about making an image. He's not supposedly talking about Dharma. But he's gone so deeply in his own way of entering right inside life, of identifying with life, that what he says is Dharma. And it's not to say that he was completely liberated and unconstrained by psychology and so on. So there are also other interpretations of his open window paintings that are more psychological. But if you ever get a chance to see even a reproduction of an open window painting by Matisse, I think you'll get what he means when he says, the wall that makes outer and inner is not separating. It's a unity of space. And that's the charm of the painting. And so here we are, trying to see deeply, feel deeply, and get deeply into life. And I think we can already see in one day here of trying to see like what's happening in my mind, what's happening in my body, what is this life? That there is some kind of sense of outer and inner. And sometimes we wish we could be more out of ourselves and sometimes more in. But I think we can also see, we could also really acknowledge and accept that dividing line between outer and inner doesn't actually strictly separate. There's a unity of space, our inner and so-called outer lines. I want to go ahead and tell another Matisse story here at the beginning. It's a really sweet story. I loved Matisse since I was a child, and there's a lot more work being done on him now. He was considered kind of, he was not cool when I was in college because it wasn't all black. It was a lot of color in his work. And now people are recognizing his brilliance a little bit more again. So he was, I think he was in his 70s, and he'd had to move from his beloved place by the coast because of the war. He had to move to another town. He took everything with him, and so he had new neighbors in his new place. And one neighbor was a 19-year-old girl who lived 4 kilometers away, and she'd heard that he was a famous artist, and she liked to draw. And so she had 2 pencil drawings that were framed in heavy frames, and she put them in a cart, and she dragged them in the cart, the 4 kilometers, and showed up at Matisse's house completely unannounced. The secretary happened not to be there. She went into his house, and she found him in his studio. And he was completely shocked, because by that time, the secretary had gotten really good at keeping people away and making them make appointments and so on. He liked to be social, but he was very organized. But her audacity just kind of moved him, and he said, "I let myself be moved." And so he said, where are these famous drawings of yours?" And they went outside to look at them. And then she started saying, "Well, how much do you think I could sell them for?" And he said, "Now you're going a little too far. You said it would take 2 minutes to look at your drawings. You wanted to know if they were good or bad. And now you want me to give you a valuation and help you sell them." But he did actually help her sell them. And she became his drawing student. And one time, an interviewer went with Matisse to meet this student who was doing charcoal drawings of olive trees in the field somewhere. And it's just it feels like such a beautiful moment. It was just a very short 3 minutes of instruction. She was drawing this olive tree that had 3 trunks. And he just came like a old master would with his own charcoal, and he just kind of underlined the most important kind of architecture of the tree on her drawing, probably without asking. But she was there asking in a way. And that's when he said to her, "One can always exaggerate in the direction of the truth." And then she asked her what was bothering her about the drawing, what felt unresolved in this drawing of the olive tree. And she said she understood what he'd underlined. She said she agreed with what he'd done. He'd underlined these 2 elegant lines of 2 of the trunks. But there was this stump. And this is where we can start to hear how we're talking about us. So there's the beautiful lines that when we see with clarity, we can really see the elegant lines in our life. But there's always the stump that we don't know what to do with. And how does that fit in this elegant drawing? And so you can hear his sense of humor, because he asks her, when she says, "What bothers me is the stump," he says, "Why don't you eliminate it?" But this was a trick question, and she didn't fall into the trap. So she was pretty connected woman. She said, "Because that would eliminate the balance. To just pretend that the stump isn't there, to draw it out, to erase it, to not leave that in as part of my subjective truth, as part of the elegance, that would mess up the harmony. That would not be harmony. That would upset the balance," is what she said. And then his next instruction to her, this is their three-minute conversation, it's like a Zen master interview. What he tells her, how to work with the stump, now that you've got the easy part, you've got the essential architecture of your life clear, but there's the stump. He says, "You see the empty spaces? They are very meaningful. It's they which will provide your balance." So he's drawn out like what stands out in the form of her drawing, or in the form of our life, what we seem to be doing, who we seem to be. But when we get to the stump and we don't know what to do, it's again that unity of space. So remember that it's not just about the elegance of form, but what is behind the scenes We could say also meaningful instead of saying more meaningful or only the spaces are meaningful. When we get to the stump, it's the spaces that will provide the resolution, we could say, will bring out the balance, will give us a way to stay with that, the elegant lines that we can see in our lives sometimes. So I want to apply this more specifically to our experience with the thinking mind. This possibility of a unity of space, of what seems to be inner and outer and dividing. And this possibility that what we tend not to look to, what we think of as nothingness or nothing, could be what resolves and gives us a way to keep flowing when we're stumped. One thing that I've noticed, and I've actually never, it's not that I've done a lot of so much reading, so tell me if you've heard people writing or talking about this, but I've never heard anyone talk about this. And I find it happens a lot, that sometimes I'll hear some thinking in my mind, and the subject might be the weather or anything else, but let's say it's the weather. And there's just a comment that just comes up in the mind, apparently out of nowhere. It might say, oh, it has never hailed here, or it hardly ever hails here. And so the content of the sentence in my mind is saying, no hail, doesn't hail. And then maybe that day it hails, for example. So it's like the subject that's being brought up in the mind seemingly out of nowhere is kind of accurate in a way. But the way that I kind of translate it into words, or the way it gets translated into words in my head, is exactly the opposite of maybe what's actually happening that day, the hail building in the clouds up there. So sometimes it could be like if we know a foreign language pretty well, but not fluently, and we're mostly understanding, but we miss that no or nipa or whatever that's saying the opposite. So it's actually the opposite of what we think is what's going on. And so sometimes we could start to translate that kind of thinking better as we start to step back and get to know what thinking is at all. Similarly with emotion, sometimes an emotion may come up and we don't actually know what it really, where it's coming from, what it really means. Sometimes one example, just to be specific again. By being specific, I don't want to stop you from really reflecting on this. Sometimes I like to be unspecific, so you have to do the reflecting. Giving an example doesn't mean that's the end of the story. So one example of an emotion coming up that might not mean what it seems to mean only. So maybe an emotion like sadness may come. And maybe that's an emotion that I or you don't usually feel, but suddenly there's sadness. And then it has its lifespan, and then the sadness is gone, and maybe the same day. It's important that we've recently touched sadness so that we could really understand what someone else is experiencing in a deep and prolonged sadness, for example. Does that make sense? It's just one example of how that could be, how it could work, that the thinking and emotional mind and heart might be open windows, that it's not only what it seems to be. It may not be as separate as it seems to be. In the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, there's a lovely statement by one of my Tibetan teachers. He said, as we are starting to feel what the mind is, we might notice that our mind doesn't seem to be very awake and very transcendent. But even so, its pattern is expressing depth. And of course, in Tibetan Buddhism, if you've ever had contact with it, it's very specific, and there's four ways that it's the pattern of our thinking mind is expressing the depth of things as they really are. So they call it the four kaya principle. So our mind may not seem to be awake or transcendent, yet its pattern is that of the four kaya principle. It does actually follow the same kind of underlying structure, might be too heavy of a word, but we'll use it for now, underlying structure or expression of the depth of things as they are. So the way they put it, when we come, let's say, into a new situation, like a retreat, in a place maybe we haven't been before, or with people we haven't been with before, at first there's a sense of openness and maybe also bewilderment or confusion or uncertainty. And that kind of quality or state of mind would be an expression of, or be in the family of, what is called dharmakaya. Akaya is a means body, and so it's dharma body. So that's like the quality of anything and everyone and everything. That's, let's say, the space that allows us to be here would be another kind of metaphorical way of understanding dharmakaya, dharma body. So dharma is invisible, but it's that aliveness without which nothing can be. And so dharma body, some kind of invisible presence, and something in the dharmakaya family is that kind of openness, where we actually don't know what's going to happen next on the schedule because we haven't memorized the schedule yet. So that's one expression of dharmakaya. That's one way that our mind follows the pattern of the four kaya principle. I think it'll make sense if we keep going through the four, but if not, we'll keep talking. What they say happens next, so we're uncertain, we're open. It's that so-called beginner's mind, literally. Not the cultivated one, but the real one. And then we start to have some kind of insight, or I would say maybe perspective. We take a perspective, we have a view about what we're doing here, what's happening here. There might be some kind of, it could be that some kind of subjective truth in that. This is what I'm doing here. And then once there's that kind of clarity, there's the openness, and then there's the clarity, that's what's called the nirmana, that's related to the nirmana kaya family, which is the constructed body. So there's the form body. So we have the invisible, the visible. And then what connects those two is like the energy body, we could say, sambhogakaya, enjoyment body, joy body. And that's where how we connect this situation of great potential to our specific approach, so that this week has, let's say, infinite potential. But we also, in a way, need a specific approach, how I am here, what's going to help most in and through me, this world and myself, this week. So that would be the form body. This is what I'm doing here. And then how those two connect, the visible and the invisible, the form and the formless, is energy body, we could say, or they call it sambhogakaya, which literally means with joy, with enjoyment. I'll give some more examples so that it becomes more clear. But since they said there's four bodies, we'll talk about the fourth too. First. The fourth one, swabhavikakaya, like as if born out of itself, out of nothing body. That's what they describe as we come into the situation, there's openness, then we have a clarity, and then we act on that clarity. And then that gives us a kind of total view of the overall situation, and that's the swabhavikakaya, the everything and nothing. So first, if we just rewind and feel, there's kind of a beauty to the possibility that our minds, even when they're just busy thinking about something that we're anxious about or that we regret or that we look forward to or whatever we're thinking about, that no matter what's the content of the mind, that the mind is still rooted in the family of depth. and is actually specifically manifesting in these four specific ways. It's following the pattern of transcendence, we could say. And so maybe in any of those four moments, if we find ourselves uncertain, we've just heard an idea that we don't understand, so there's uncertainty, bewilderment, confusion. In that, we could tap into the openness that's there instead of maybe closing down into feeling like to making an interpretation of what's happening. If we suddenly get an insight about, this is what I want to practice here, or that feels really right to me here in the situation, we could go too far and hold on to the idea that comes with that insight and start trading in ideas and thoughts again, or we could tune into that clarity. So it's showing us the possibility that even our busy, aggressive, stupid minds, thinking minds, are constantly giving open windows into something else. So we could even appreciate the most ridiculous thoughts as windows that actually don't separate us. They don't make us an inside and an outside. Even the most horrible thought or the most beautiful thought doesn't make us special, doesn't make us worse than or better than, or even equal to, incomparable. So when there's a flash of insight about, maybe that's what's going on, we could tap into that quickness and clarity, kind of sense of reality and brightness. We could. Anytime that we think, that's for lunch, we could feel the quickness and clarity. We go to lunch, we don't know what's for lunch. There's the openness. We could tap into the openness. We see what's for lunch. We think we know what's for lunch. That's Chick-fil-A? No, tempeh. Oh, okay. Great. I love tempeh. And there we can tap into the quickness and brightness of the mind when that thought happens. And then when there's the action of taking the Chick-fil-A tempeh or whatever, we could tap into the kind of magic, alchemical kind of property of what they call the energy body, of what's not invisible, what's not visible. It's kind of like the window itself that's connecting the outside and the inside, or the visible and the invisible. We could tap into that magic, directness, action, alchemy. Just in the moment of getting the plate or putting the salad on the plate. And then there's the fourth body, the Svabhavika Kaya, of just, whoa, this whole buffet of food that came out of everywhere and nowhere. We could tap into that too. Does that make a little more sense with when we talked about food? Okay. So I'd like to encourage all of us, including myself, to really allow the time of what we could call formal meditation or official meditation, or the time in the hall where we're actually lying down or sitting or standing, as a time simply for resting, and resting in a way that's different from what we thought resting was, so different from escaping. We're resting and we're kind of laying ourselves bare, but not to anyone else. We're laying ourselves bare just in that openness. We're letting ourselves be an open window and not demanding anything else. We're not demanding to be shown or to show or to be a shower or whatever. But if we could give that a chance, if this is your first time, then it's hard to really go for that. For three, I usually say, like, give it at least 3 days where you're really literally resting as much as you possibly can, which might be even a little more than you kind of feel comfortable with. And usually on the third day, towards the end of the third day, it does start to be clear what happens, that things do show up in that open window. And then meanwhile, all the time out of the hall is free time where we're really encouraged, we could say, to play hide and seek. If we could kind of catch that little girl or little boy inside that really wants to play hide and seek, that really feels the joy of catching the ways that we're cheating ourselves as a game, not like trying to get us to then punish us. So this morning, Gan was playing with Melissa, and he just, a few days ago, learned about this game of hide and seek. My son, Gan, sorry. And he said, let's all play catch together, something like that. And then he said, I'll go hide. I'm going to go hide in there. And he pointed to one. I'm going to go hide in there. Now you come catch me. And we said, okay, we'll count to 10, and then we'll come get you. But he wanted to count with us, 1 through 10. And then he will go hide, and we'll go catch him. And just last week, my friend who has a daughter who's a little bit older than Gan said, this is what she used to do. She would tell me where she's going to hide, and then she would tell me to come get her. So we can do the same thing. We can tell ourselves where we're going to hide, where we're hiding, and come and get me. Let's go play, all play catch together. So in the so-called informal meditation, in the Tibetan tradition, it's called post-meditation, what we do when we're leaving the meditation hall, or even as soon as the bell rings, when we think we're off the hook, off duty. If that could be when we let ourselves catch ourselves, because what we know we most want is to not cheat ourselves. By letting us practice in that way, which will give us a lot of times to also catch that open window of the Dharmakaya openness, uncertainty, and then the clarity, and then the action, and then the total picture. 4 different windows, or they call them bodies for some reason. This teacher of mine says, you begin to realize that the essence of your mind is empty, that the nature of your mind is light and clear, and that the expression or manifestation of your mind is active. That realization can only come about when you are on the cushion. There is no place from which thoughts arise, as far as you can judge by looking at them. So that's what he means by saying empty. It's a word that I don't usually like to use, but once in 10 years we can say. That's what they mean by Dharmakaya, that openness and not knowing and uncertainty, and that we can tap into and really see that it's might be really true in my own experience that all of these thoughts are just spouting forth. And sometimes it's interesting to look at what they're saying, and sometimes the subject is more or less on target, even if I'm mistranslating it to myself. It's not going to hail, or it is going to hail. But it's also interesting just to see that they're just spouting. And as far as we can tell by looking at them, they're coming from nowhere. They're just there. So that's the Dharmakaya again, another example. The openness. As far as you can judge by looking at them, they just arise from no place, or there's no place they arrive from. That's a better way to say it. Then secondly, you also have no idea where your thoughts go. Sometimes this, where they come from, where they go, you might have more of a feeling for one or the other. It might catch your attention more to think, where did they come from? Or it might catch your attention more to feel like, it's gone, where did it go? But it could be interesting to try to feel both. Thoughts just come and they vanish, they just disappear. As you continue to practice mindfulness and awareness, the seeming confusion and chaos in your mind begin to seem absurd. The point is not to make your mind a blank. It is just that you begin to see that nothing is actually happening. And at the same time, I don't see where I put the rest of the words, but he says, although it seems that there's so much happening in the mind. Basically, what's happening is just this kind of, these patterns of openness, clarity, brightness, and then action. Alchemy, I think alchemy is more clear than action. The the invisible Dharmakaya, and the visible, the form, what's more obvious, the clear, how I'm going to go about this week kind of insight. They're made to have a chemistry. And so when that chemistry happens, when they're in the right environment for, when they're in the presence of a catalyst, then they do interact. So that catalyst is the energy. And then we can just kind of feel the whole show with much more of a sense of humor. It helps us to notice that we're not the only ones with that spouting of brilliant and ridiculous thoughts, of genuine and borrowed emotions, and of something that's deeper than that, the capacity to actually feel our aliveness, to actually let ourselves be this bare open window. A couple of weeks ago, I had been in nature, let's say, camping by a river, and then came into Barcelona, and the whole thing that is not, still not something I'm very used to, like finding a parking place and then taking everything out of the car, even though there's not any room to open the back of the car and the traffic is going on the other side and people are sitting at the cafe table on this side. And that was the moment. And then there's Jan also. And somehow in all of that chaos, someone who was sitting at the cafe next to the car and the piles of stuff and Jan was on my hip. This older man, he must have been upper 60s, I think, was sitting down and Jan was on me, and they just had eye contact between Jan and the man, and I was able to see the eye contact between them. This happens a lot and it's lovely. And I dared to just watch more than I usually do. I usually just let the people have their moment. But I kind of was drawn to watch the man's face as he looked at Jan. And I would say I allowed myself to see something there that I had not noticed before about us human beings. What I think was there was what we often would easily, kind of maybe even almost nearly flippantly say, the inner child of the man. And since that's such a kind of trite phrase now, I made effort to feel, what do I mean by that? That feels true, but come on, what do I really mean? What do we mean by the child inside us? And partly what I think I felt was us, so not just him, but us in our potential, which it seemed to me this man was aware of being unable to live out some of his potential, that he'd gone too far down some roads to be able to fully live some of the potential, but that he still had a freshness. It didn't matter, also. So there was a kind of sadness and a kind of brightness. Which I think is relieving. That both things are relieving. That it is important to let our potential flower in every way we can. That's what we need, but also what the world needs from us. Like letting that window be open and seeing what shows up and what isn't separate, to let that alchemy happen at the window. And also, it's just never too late. It doesn't matter how many times we didn't let the potential flower, because the potential is just purely there. Here. And I want to acknowledge how it was difficult to see that, to see his eyes, and it's difficult to really say what I mean, because it's so much what we're about. if we could imagine that we would see ourselves the way that I was able to see this person, maybe I just imagined all of this, but what then I saw of me by looking at his eyes. Is that no matter what's going on, whatever seems to be going on, there is the openness. Like, we are not without that openness. No matter how closed-minded we might feel at any one time. And what helps us be intimate with the openness? Because it feels so dangerous to be intimate with the openness. And then there's also that spark of clarity, like this was just a moment of meeting that I might be imagining, but that seemed to happen just on a street. Like the potential meeting happened. That clarity and brightness met itself there. And what helps us bring out that in ourselves and in others. And then not to leave out this energy, this alchemy. It's not just openness, vast potential, and then little isolated insights. It's how that acts. How that has an effect. How that transforms. And maybe that's what is scary, is like walking into that gaze or meeting or that open window. It's like with our eyes open, letting ourselves be turned inside out and not saying, okay, doctor, wake me up when it's over. I just remember the confidence of the 19-year-old who just went with these huge framed pencil drawings to Matisse's house, inside the house. And didn't give up when he was like, what are you doing here? If we could feel how letting ourselves awake, walk into that being turned inside out. If we could feel how that it's not just for me, it's not just for myself. How even if it were only for me, it would be worthwhile. And luckily, it's not only for me. That man meeting my son has given me so much. And then the overall picture, the Svabhavika Kaya. Where there is that openness and that definition and that alchemy. Where it's like the invisible and the visible are in love. And then there's also the as if this or anything else could be on the stage. All of this is what we are, and we could either say more, or even that doesn't begin to describe it. The importance of the openness, the vastness, and also that specific way that each of us would meet a child's gaze in our own way. Each of us would allow our potential, the vast potential that we all have, to be expressed through our uniqueness. And the kind of absolute need for that differentness, that uniqueness, that not copying, that reaching for the space between, so that we don't think the stump is a problem. So that we don't think our problem is really a problem. That no matter what, we could actually know it, that our problem is not really a problem. And we can let the openness and the clarity and the alchemy do some healing. That's what it likes to do. And there's no problem. And so why not? In the Tibetan tradition, they talk about this tuning into the four kayas as the best protection, which is a kind of a joke and kind of reaching into the space in us that wants to be reached into for harmony. It's the best protection because we're not leaving anywhere for anything to land that could attack or seduce or ignore or whatever. And so one of my Tibetan teachers says, with his typical sense of humor, what he loves about this teaching and what he loves about calling it the best protection is that you're not talking about egolessness here. You're trying to work out your protection. So we think that we're finally going to get some protection that we can count on. We're not trying to talk about egolessness and trying to be egoless. But you might find yourself being egoless and realizing there is nothing to protect. So it's just the open window where we don't pretend that there's not inner and outer, but we also don't pretend that inner and outer is separate. And right there, being turned inside out, the thought of what to protect, like which way, what would I protect, this way or the in-between. And yet they use the word protection. It allows our potential for fluid living and creative solutions. Just in a childlike way, not in a scheming or trying way, strategizing way. It just allows that fluid living to happen. Does anyone have a question or anything to comment or say? So why don't we actually stay with, we have 15 more minutes to just be in the hall and digest and filter. Maybe with the AC on? If that's okay.